Clause 8 is part of IP Watchdog and sponsored by Harrity, the go-to firm for the Patent 300 for patent preparation and prosecution. If you enjoy this podcast, please share with others and leave a 5-star rating. And now here's your host, Eli Mazur.
Today, we're lucky to be joined by Geoff Wild, the legendary founder and longtime editor of IAM. IAM covers the business of IP around the world, and Geoff has been reporting on IP issues from London since 1992. When we first scheduled the interview, I was planning to mostly focus on IAM and the world of IP media, but there's been a barrage of news from Europe in the last month or so, so we'll definitely get to that as well. I obviously always knew about Geoff and always thought about having him on the podcast, but I recently had lunch with Richard Loy, your former North American editor, and we were talking about your incredible ability not only to stay somehow on top of all the patent and IP issues around the world, but also to be able to provide kind of valuable insights about all these issues. And he couldn't stop raving about you. I don't think I met anybody who genuinely liked their old boss so much. So after that, I thought, all right, I finally have to invite Geoff to come on Clause 8. So thank you so much for joining.
Oh, it's great to be here. Richard was brilliant to work with for many, many years. He was an absolute dream to work with. I remember breaking stories with him at midnight UK time, some of the most exciting times as a journalist I've had. So it's great to hear that Richard said that about me.
How did you get your reporters and editors to like you so much? What was your style as an editor of IAM?
I don't think that all my reporters and editors like me very much. I think the point about being an editor of any publication or platform is that you have got to have confidence in your team. You can't micromanage your team. You've got to let your team get on with it, go and get the stories. As long as they're performing to a level that is acceptable to you, then you should basically let them get on with it. And I always got on well with the journalists and editors that worked with me who were able to do that. And Richard was one of those. And we had a really good team for quite a number of years because of that, both in Washington, D.C. with Richard, the team that we had in Hong Kong, and also in London.
So we'll get more to IAM, but I want to, I guess, kind of go back in time. I think you kind of started your career in 1992 covering IP. How did you get into that? How did you get into covering patent IP issues as a journalist?
I am a journalist. I'm not a patent person. I'm not an attorney or a lawyer or an engineer or anything like that. I was actually working in Madrid in Spain for a magazine called Hello, which is a gossip magazine that had just launched a UK edition. It was a Spanish publication, just launched a UK edition, and I was over in Spain basically managing the process of getting the English version up to the UK, making sure it was all in English and everything. And I finished that job in 1992, came back to the UK, needed a job in journalism, saw one being advertised as editor of Copyright World, had no idea what that was, but decided I needed a job, so applied for it. I think I must have been the only one that did because I got it. And that basically set me on the road. I was editor of Copyright World. Then I became editor of its sister publication, Patent World. In 1994, I was approached by Euromoney and asked to become editor of Managing Intellectual Property, MIP. And I was editor of MIP for a few years. And then I left Euromoney in around 2000 to become a freelance, worked for various publications, writing IP stories, Financial Times, Wall Street Journal, people like that. And during all that time, it became obvious to me that IP was a lot more than laws and court decisions and regulations and things like that, that it was very obvious that IP was becoming a fundamental business asset, one that people could use to generate profits, build partnerships, go out into the markets and raise cash, all that kind of thing. But no one was writing about that. There was no coverage of that. So that said to me there was an opportunity to create something new. And so with some colleagues, put together IAM and launched that in 2003 and went from there, really.
You mentioned, I think, your job before you were covering patent issues and IP issues was for a gossip magazine. Obviously, London is a home to a lot of famous newspapers and tabloids and so forth. Do you think that informed your sense into how to make patent news interesting, how to make it relevant at all, that wasn't done before?
Well, maybe. I don't know. I've never really thought about that. That's an interesting point. I think, well, it's, you know, as a journalist, what you're doing is you're always looking for a story. So you're looking for a hook, you're looking for an angle, you're looking for something that other people haven't got. You're competing with other people to get the story first in some situations. And maybe as a journalist, you understand that more than if you're an IP lawyer or what have you, because your training is very different. Your timeline is very different. The way that you look at stories is going to be very different. And, you know, for an IP lawyer or an attorney or someone like that, getting the story out isn't the first priority. The first priority is to look after your client, is to understand the decision or understand the new law. For us, or for me, it's about getting the story out. Obviously, you have to understand it, but it's getting it out before anyone else and getting the angle that no one else has. And if you're trained as a journalist, you know how to do the headline, you know how to do the stand first, you know how to do the opening paragraph, maybe in a way that other people don't. So, yeah, I guess there's some advantages, but, you know, the other advantage for me was that when I got into IP, I just found everyone incredibly helpful, really enthusiastic and keen to share information and keen to share knowledge and keen to share perspectives. And so I think without the buy-in from the community, from the IP community, none of this would have been possible. And so been one of the great privileges of my life has been to share this environment with so many fantastic people that work in IP in all kinds of ways.
I think you've talked about how when you came up with the idea for IAM, you really thought about your target audience as being those chief IP officers, those people inside corporations who are responsible for managing portfolios and creating values for portfolios. Two questions. One is just my own curiosity is, did you think, what made you confident that there's enough of them out there who would be interested in reading news about IP?
I can't claim credit for the term chief IP officer. Obviously, that's been floating around for a long time. I spent a lot of time in the early years of IAM speaking to a couple of guys, Rob Stern of Stern Kessler and Ron Laurie. And both of those I consider visionaries in terms of this type of this part of the marketplace. And we worked very closely together on kind of developing the perspectives of what the chief IP officer was all about. There actually weren't that many of them out there, certainly at the beginning. It was kind of more of a, if you create it, they will come kind of idea. There were people like Ruth Peters at Philips, one or two other people doing it, but mostly it was kind of an ideal. If you create the idea of someone that is responsible not just for managing a portfolio and managing the risk around that portfolio, but is also someone who is responsible for creating value and doing deals, if you create the notion that that person exists, then more people, more of those kinds of people will begin to exist, or people will want to be like that kind of person. And other people will want to be advising that person or selling products to that person. And in that way, you kind of create an ecosystem. In publishing terms, you would call it a buy-sell relationship. So if you put the chief IP officer, say, in the middle of a circle, and you got all these spokes feeding into it, all the people that want to speak to the chief IP officer, then you create a publishing ecosystem where people will buy subscriptions, will buy ad slots, will want to attend events and all the rest of it. It worked. Again, you know, thanks to the buy-in that we got from people in the IP community. And, you know, really important to name check Ron and Rob as well. They were very important to developing the whole idea.
That's interesting. So when you came up with this idea, the concept of even a chief IP officer didn't really exist the way we think about it today, or it's obviously pretty commonplace now. What are they interested in? What are chief IP officers interested in? Obviously, they're super busy on a day-to-day basis, but what do they want to know more about?
In terms of publishing, I'll be very crude, but put it very crudely. Obviously, it's much more sophisticated than I'm about to say, but what they want to know about is danger and opportunity. They want information that will enable them to make decisions that will either protect their position or enhance their position. So you're always looking for stories and angles that will enable them to do this. So, you know, you're talking about deals and how those deals worked and kind of the deals that didn't work and why they didn't work. You're trying to break news about deals and legislation. You want to get interviews with major players as well so that you can interrogate those players and they can share their perspectives on things. And if you do all of that well enough, frequently enough, then people will begin to buy into what you're doing. It's all about understanding the matrix from a publishing perspective and the buy-sell relationships and making sure you go out and deliver. Because, I mean, the one thing that you can't do is make promises and then not deliver on them. And that, you know, that takes us back to having a really strong editorial team with people like Richard in it, because when you've got those people, you know that you will be delivering.
I'm sure you've met a lot and observed lots of chief IP officers and their careers. Is there anything that I guess stands out to you in terms of what separates the really successful ones from the rest? Certain personality traits, certain way they approach the job, anything?
It's a really interesting question, because it's actually a real strength, but also a weakness of the whole concept of the chief IP officer as it is. That the really successful chief IP officers will be visionaries. There will be people that can see things other people can't see, and they will see those internally within their own organizations, but they'll also see that externally in terms of the relationships that they can build and the opportunities that are out there that can be grabbed. But the problem with that, I think, is that you become very dependent on that individual. What I don't think we've yet got to in IP is a point where there is clean succession from one generation to the next generation. That if you've had one successful, really successful chief IP officer, the next one will be as successful and the next one will be as successful. It's not, in my mind, it hasn't yet become an institutionalized role in, say, the way that a chief financial officer is an institutionalized role. That, you know, there is a way to train chief financial officers and there are things that all chief financial officers will do, attributes that they will all possess. Some will be better than others, but there's kind of a baseline of performance standard. And I'm not sure that we're at that stage necessarily with chief IP officers. So what you'll often see is someone will rise up to be a chief IP officer, but they will then be succeeded by someone who becomes head of IP or chief patent counsel or chief IP counsel or something like that. And so the kind of the role might slip back in to being a legal one rather than the kind of the business opportunity that it had been previously. So I'm not sure if that makes sense as an answer, but I think at the moment it's very dependent on the individual rather than a kind of a collective understanding of what the role is within an organization.
No, that's very interesting, because often you see a company have a very successful, I guess, IP strategy, being very active or, as you say, visionary in how they use their IP and so forth. And then that person leaves, the chief IP officer, and it seems the company has decided to take a different strategy, and sometimes it is, but it really could be just nobody could really figure out how to do that as successfully.
Absolutely. I think that's the thing. You know, maybe visionaries themselves don't think enough about succession planning, or maybe they haven't in the past. Maybe that's beginning to change now. But, you know, maybe one of the attributes of a really top-class chief IP officer from now and into the future has to be someone that is able to do succession planning as well, to get a line of talent in place so that when that person leaves, it's seamless and everything can carry on as it is. I think, you know, one of the other things that's really important is the communication with the board, with the CFO. And if you lose that ability to communicate, then again, kind of the role of IP within an organization might become downgraded just because the advocacy isn't there anymore. The relationship isn't there anymore, and the ability to actually make the case for IP and demonstrate its efficacy has kind of disappeared.
One of the trademark stories of IAM, no pun intended, is, you know, these stories about where IAM kind of shares IP strategies of major companies, right? And I think you've been doing it since your first issues.
Yeah.
And obviously those are super interesting to read for everybody, because for outside counsel, they want to know what are in-house counsel thinking about in terms of patent strategies and so forth. Other chief patent counsel and so forth, in-house counsel, want to know, well, what are the best strategies out there? Should we kind of improve what we're doing? But usually attorneys who occupy those roles, you know, they're very risk averse, right? You mentioned they worry about risk a lot. Was it hard to get them to share those strategies, like for that first issue?
For the first few issues, it was a nightmare, yeah, because no one knew who we were. I mean, I obviously, because I've been working in IP journalism for a while, I knew a few people, so we called in a few favours. But actually, we were very lucky in launching IAM because we launched at a time when incredible things were beginning to happen. And I should name check here someone else, a guy called Bruce Berman.
A previous closet guest, yeah.
He was working at the time with Marshall Phelps. And Marshall Phelps, but what Bruce did was put us in touch with Marshall Phelps literally at the time when he joined Microsoft. And so we got the inside scoop on all of that because of the personal connection we had. And Bruce was actually a very long-standing friend of IAM and wrote for us for a number of years. But that was fortunate. But coincidentally, almost at the very same time, the first IV fund began. So kind of we had proof of concept very early on in IAM's existence. And because we were writing about stuff that other people weren't writing about, the people involved in that stuff really had nowhere else to go in terms of doing interviews and providing insight. So, you know, we were lucky to launch when we did. We were lucky to have the friends that we did, but we were also lucky, frankly, that we didn't have any competition in the early days. You know, if the FT or Wall Street Journal or, you know, even one of the established IP publications had kind of hit upon the idea that we had, it might have been much more difficult. But we were given an open road for a number of years, and that enabled us to sort of create the foundations for IAM.
So what do you think companies see as the benefit to sharing their internal secrets about how they think about building their portfolio and monetizing it, not monetizing it?
It's a good question. It's one that I actually asked Ruud Peeters when he was chief IP officer at Philips. You know, why Ruud, why do you spend so much time speaking to people like me, attending events, sharing the secrets of Philips' success and how they do deals and what have you? And he said, we need other people. We need other people in the marketplace. If it was just Philips, we couldn't do deals. You know, if it was just Philips doing it, there would be no market. So I'm out there creating knowledge, sharing information, because in that way we build a bigger market and that creates more opportunities for us. And I guess that's part of being a visionary, is you can see beyond sort of the narrow confines of your immediate interest as a business to think longer term and much more widely about how you're going to develop over a number of years rather than from quarter to quarter.
So it's really about supporting the ecosystem as a whole than your immediate interest for that company or as a professional.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you want, if there's just two people that know all about IP and IP deal making and the value of patents, then those two people can talk to each other. They can do a deal. And then what? You need other people that have the same level of knowledge. And that's the way that you grow everything.
Have you, I guess, come across any downside or risk about sharing too much?
I have sometimes been surprised that people have told us stuff that they have, but they have. And so, you know, that's fair game. There have been other times when people have kind of realized that they've said too much and kind of said no before we published. And, you know, you have to respect that. You can't, you don't want to, as much as you've got a great story immediately, you ruin a load of connections for the longer term and no one wins out of that. So yeah, I mean, there are times when things like that happen. But frankly, you know, we have a very sophisticated, intelligent readership, and we're speaking to very sophisticated, intelligent people. So it doesn't happen that often. These people, you know, they know what they're doing, they know what they're saying, and they're saying what they want to say.
From my experience, sometimes the opposite is true.
Well, I mean, like, you know, if someone doesn't want to talk to you, they don't want to talk to you, and so you don't talk to them anymore. You know, there are people that you come across that aren't great, that are quite, you know, that are hostile and what have you, and you just learn to step by them. You know, there are other people out there, so you know, you shouldn't never get too hung up on what one person says or does.
Too many stories to cover, anyways. IAM wasn't only like a visionary in the IP media space, but in the media space as a whole. If you really look about when you guys started and some, you know, the things that media companies are doing now, and two things come to mind. One is subscription, you know, the fact that you have a pretty strong paywall for your online content. And second is the conferences, right, which is a huge part of IAM's business from what I understand. Tell us a little bit about how you came upon those ideas. And
yeah, well, I mean, the subscription is, you know, that's kind of the lifeblood of a platform. If you don't charge people for a subscription, then you don't have a business. So, you know, you've got to do that. The conferences, again, kind of serendipity, really. We worked, the first event we did was in Amsterdam. I think it was 2007, 2006. And we worked with Ocean Tomo on that when Ocean Tomo were doing their auctions. And Ocean Tomo, I think it was the first patent auction they did in Europe, and they wanted to build an event around it. And so they approached us to build the event. And we created a kind of a day and a half program. And then they held their auction on the final afternoon of the second day. We had no idea how it would go. No idea at all. None of us have done these events before. But we got 450 people there. And we thought, blimey, there's something in this. Let's give it a go. And so that's what we did. And that's how we launched IPBC. It was, you know, proof of concept was the Ocean Tomo event. And from then on, we thought, well, we could do this ourselves and do it for 2 days and bring the community together. And it was, again, it's all about the buy sells. If you get enough senior chief IP officers attending an event, then other people will want to come as well. And sort of over recent years, the challenge for us has been, how do we ensure that the chief IP officers still keep coming? And the way you do that, unfortunately for everyone else, is that you have quotas that, you know, if you're an IP owner, then you're very welcome to come to IPBC and fantastic. But if you're providing services to IP owners or you're working in private practice or anything like that, then there's a quota. So we don't get an event that is flooded with people throwing business cards at chief IP officers. But yeah, I mean, it was a fantastic thing to do. And you know, thanks to Ocean Tomo, we managed to do it.
Do you have any concerns as a journalist about potential conflicts in terms of the people sponsoring and making these conferences happen, and then you have to cover them and maybe think about whether you should write a story that they might not like or like?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are always concerns around that. Absolutely. I think it's a very important point. We are not involved as journalists in sponsorship. So we don't get involved in selling sponsorships or identifying sponsors or anything like that. And we also have a separate production team that put the event together. So they will come to journalists and ask, you know, what are the key subjects that are being discussed at the moment? What do you think we should be covering in terms of topics? And we provide input on that. But it's the production team that puts the event program together. So there's no conflict in that sense. Is there a conflict when you see that a company X is a gold sponsor of an event? Is there a conflict then that you don't want to cause them any difficulty? You don't want to have negative coverage of what they're doing or anything like that? Again, I think that is a danger. But you're not doing anyone a favor by pretending that stories aren't happening if they are happening. You're not doing anyone a favor by pretending that something hasn't happened if it has happened. And why does someone want to spend a lot of money sponsoring IPBC or becoming a subscriber or what have you? Because they want to be associated with the brand. And they want to be associated with the brand because the brand is considered to be very high quality. And it's considered to be very high quality because it provides information and analysis and all the rest of it that you can't get from elsewhere. So if IAM was a platform that didn't cover stories because they were difficult for sponsors or because they were told they couldn't do it or anything like that, people wouldn't want to be associated with IAM in the first place. They wouldn't buy a subscription. That's always the way I've thought about it. One thing I should say point. You can't, you know, in the end, you cannot charge the subscription prices that IAM charges. You cannot charge the sponsorship fees that IAM charges if you're a compromised second-rate brand. You've got to be going out there and getting the best stories and providing the highest quality analysis every single time, no matter who it cheeses off on one occasion or another. And again, look, I mean, our readership and our sponsors are sophisticated, intelligent people. They understand. I have to say that, you know, I was editor of IAM for close to 20 years, editor-in-chief for all that time. At no point was I ever approached by any sponsor or subscriber and told, don't run that story. Or if you run that story, we're no longer going to be associated with you. And to be fair, it never happened internally ever either. We never had business development people contacting us and saying that. Because from the very start, when I established IAM, I established it as a journalist, and I kind of wanted it to be journalist-led and content-led. And from the very start, we put that kind of Chinese wall up there because we were aware that there could be conflicts. But it's never actually happened in real life. One thing I should say, Eli, is that I am no longer editor of IAM or editor-in-chief of IAM. So I'm still not retired long enough to say they. I keep saying we, but it's not. I'm, you know, these decisions are no longer.
Sorry, I should have said that.
Fine. But yeah, these decisions are no longer being taken by me or anything like that. So I'm speaking from my experience, not on behalf of IAM or anything like that.
When I think about your views and the, you know, how IAM covers IP-related news or patent-related news, you know, they generally seem to fall on the pro-patent side of things. How did that develop, if you do think that's a fair characterization? Because obviously you kind of just fell into this world. What made you think patents are a good thing?
Well, I mean, I think pro-patent, I had an interesting conversation with Sean Ambwami about this from Unified recently. He made me think about it. I am pro-patent, I am pro-IP, but I think a lot of the people that sometimes on the other side of the argument are also pro-patent, but they're pro-patent in a different way. So I used to use the term pro-patent and anti-patent quite liberally. I'm now a lot more sort of guarded about how I use it because I think it's quite inflammatory. But putting all that...
You're retired.
Putting all that to one side, what I would say is I'm pro-patent because I believe the patents work. I believe that patents create incentives for people to invest in R&D. I believe that patents enable collaborations. They do build wealth. They do help to diffuse technology and knowledge and all the rest of it. You know, I've been looking at this marketplace for 30 years and I've seen it happen. You know, you look at connectivity and connectivity patents and standard essential patents, you look at what they have enabled over the last 10 to 15 years. Look at the development of the iPhone or the, you know, the mobile phone. Look at what we did during lockdown and how we spoke to each other. Look at what we're doing now. You know, at the bottom of that is the patent system. Same thing with COVID vaccines. You know, at the bottom of that, it was companies and institutions and universities working together that their business models were based on the patent system, on the IP system. They were able to work together incredibly quickly, incredibly effectively, and incredibly creatively to create a vaccine within 18 months of this thing, of this COVID horror show arising. You know, there is proof of concept everywhere you look in terms of how effective patents are. So how can you not be pro-patent? I mean, I think I find it very difficult to sustain an argument that we would be in a better world if patents didn't exist, put it that way. And it's, you know, similar with other forms of intellectual property as well. So that's why I'm, you know, pro-patent.
The fact that IAM's first conference was co-sponsored with Ocean Tomo, obviously their initial idea, and there was a lot of hype about it, that they would auction off patents, live auctions. I think they had an idea for a stock market and all that.
Yeah.
You mentioned intellectual ventures. There was a lot of hype about that. You know, I think they were going to invent on their own and get patents on their own. Then they started buying buying patents and I guess became more traditional NP. More recently, litigation funders, there's a lot of excitement about that. A lot of them are turning into, I guess, more traditional NPs as well in terms of how they operate. You've seen the rise and fall of many of these models. Any of that, besides the ones we discussed, that stick out to you? What did you think every time you hear about this new idea out there?
I think that patents are inherently complex. That's the problem with them. I mean, people always make this comparison between intellectual property and real property, for example. But for me, patents and IP is much more contextual. That, you know, you could give my mum an apartment on, you know, overlooking Central Park in New York, and that apartment would be worth $30 or $40 million or whatever it would be worth, whether my mum owned it, whether Donald Trump owned it, or whether whoever owned it. You give my mum the IBM patent portfolio to look after, and it immediately loses all value because she has absolutely no idea what to do with it. She has no concept of how it works. She doesn't understand the technology that's within it. She doesn't understand the relationships out with of IBM that might create value from it. And so there is so much more context in patents than there is in other forms of property or any other asset class. And I think the issue is that there aren't many people that understand that and understand how to leverage value. Those that do make a very good living from it. But until the whole concept of intellectual property and patents as an asset class is embraced by a broader sort of community within the finance sector, we're always going to have these peaks and troughs of ideas and what have you. I think the encouraging thing is that there are signs that the wider finance community is beginning to look at patents. You know, we're a long way, I think, from patents becoming any kind of serious asset class. And I think inherently they're always going to struggle to be seen as such in a way that other asset classes aren't.
I mean, what motivated, do you think, these people to think that some of these models could work?
Well, they did work for them. They did work for them. You know, people at IV made a very good living out of it for a number of years. So, you know, it worked. It worked for IV. And, you know, you look at all the people that used to be at IV and at other places now doing similar kind of things or derivative things or what have you. There is an ecosystem of people that are doing it. And they're doing it because they make a good living out of it. And they make a good living out of it because they know stuff that other people don't. And so there is a leverage opportunity there. It's that ability to go into a portfolio and analyze it and select what the strong patterns are and understand that a lot of this stuff isn't going to be valuable and all the rest of it. That's the opportunity. And as I say, at the moment, there aren't many people that do that. It might be that in a few years, AI and big data and things like that is going to change the game, and you'll be able to sort of be able to press a few buttons and do this a lot more mechanically. And that's beginning to happen already. And I suspect that the more that happens, the more mainstream finance is going to get involved in this, and the kind of inherent advantages that patent people have at the moment may not exist in a few years' time.
Another interesting change that you've seen in your, I'm sure you've seen over your career, and get your thoughts. You know, when I recently interviewed Tim Pullman, and he got his start working for some, I think, German government agency that got interested in patents because Nokia was being sued for patent infringement, the patent troll of the day. And then Ericsson actually went, first experience in the U.S. patent system was trying to invalidate patents because they were a huge implementer. And now both of these companies, European companies, kind of are well known in the standard essential patent worlds more for being innovators as licensors who are trying to monetize their patent portfolios. What do you think are the lessons from that, of these companies, that other companies should take, in how they approach the patent system?
Well, I mean, like, you know, you look at companies like Ericsson and Nokia and what have you, and they have obviously developed and transitioned over the years, but the reason they're able to monetize their patents so successfully now is that they invested in patents over a long period of time, and they invested a lot of money in R&D over a long period of time, and the patents they got on the back of the R&D were strong patents of high quality that rid on really important technology. And, you know, I think the lesson for any company is that you can use patents to create value for the company, but you have to be committed to it. You can't do it on the cheap. It's not just about going out and getting a patent. It's about getting the right kind of patent, reading on the right kind of technology. And if you do that, then you've got a chance, even if your initial business doesn't work out in the way that you thought, you've still got an opportunity to monetize the investments that you've previously made. And, you know, that's a very strong lesson I get from companies like Ericsson and Nokia, even BlackBerry, people like that. It's being committed to high quality IP procurement, I think. If you're committed to that, then that gives you very significant options further down the line.
As I mentioned in the beginning, there's lots of controversy surrounding the new proposals in Europe, specifically related to standard essential patents. This is what you wrote in April in IM. If you want proof that patent policymaking is not taken seriously in Europe, then you only need to look at the European Commission's draft regulation, SCP licensing, and the impact assessment that accompanies it. For our US-based audience, we could take a step back. Can you tell us, what is this European Commission and why does it get to come up with all these laws for Europe?
So the European Commission is based in Brussels, and the European Commission is basically, you think about it, as the administration of the European Union. So it's where kind of policy develops and law originates. And it's divided into lots of different areas, competition law, internal market, dozens of others like SMEs, things like that. And all these DGs, these Directorate Generals, are different departments within the Commission. And they are constantly developing policy. And every now and again, they will promulgate a regulation or a directive. And then they will put that in front of the member states and the European Parliament. And if the member states of the EU and the European Parliament agree, that regulation or that directive will become law. Don't want to get too technical, but if it's a directive, I believe that there is some leeway to interpret the directive at a national level. If it's a regulation, you have to implement the regulation as it is written into your national law. But it's all done. It's the Commission doesn't say this is a law. The Commission suggests the law, and then it has to be approved by the member states and the European Parliament. So what they've done with the SCP,
Those are regulations, right? Those are not directives, I guess.
Yeah. So what they've done with the SCP is they've put together this regulation. That, you know, according to a lot of people, and I agree, is a fundamental reworking of the entire SCP licensing framework in Europe. Creates much greater burdens on SCP holders than there have been up to now. Is likely to increase their costs, reduce their royalties, make it much harder for them to enforce their patents. It's going to hand over a role to the EU IP office, which is currently the issuer of trademarks and design rights in Europe, and make that a place where you must register your SCPs and they will determine FRAN royalties and all the rest of it. It's a complete rewriting of the entire SCP licensing framework in Europe at a time when Europe had actually achieved global leadership, I think, in SCP FRAN issues via the Huawei v ZTE decision and its interpretation in various national courts. And then with the sort of appearance of the Unified Patent Court at the beginning of June, I think all of that's now very much up in the air. And it all seems entirely unnecessary to me because there is very little, if any, evidence that there is an inefficient marketplace out there. There is very little litigation. The Commission is very, very concerned about SMEs. There is very little to no evidence that SMEs are adversely affected by SCP licensing. And it just seems to me a crazy idea to throw everything away and risk all of that on the back of no evidence. And it's something, you know, something similar happened in the US, I think, has happened in the US over the last 10 years. A lot of evidence-free policy. And I think a lot of people in the US would argue that's been quite damaging to US interests. And it just seems silly that the Europeans are now going to be going down the same route.
What do you think drove the European Commission to tackle this issue in the first place? What was
the impetus for that? There has been extensive lobbying. Very, very extensive lobbying by people, frankly, that don't want to pay as much money as they do now for standard essential patents. And they have been trying to persuade the Commission for a number of years that there is a massive crisis in Europe, that US-style patent trolls are about to enter the European marketplace, that there are huge inefficiencies that are handicapping the ability of European companies to develop innovative products and all the rest of it. And they've succeeded, quite frankly. And the issue is an issue that you see throughout the world. Yeah, I mean, there are always going to be more implementers of standard essential patents than there are creators of standard essential patents. And the implementers are always going to have more money to spend on lobbying and all the rest of it than the creators of standard essential patents. And in Europe, as in the US, it seems, the amount of lobbying money that you have is pretty fundamental to getting your arguments across to the people that make these decisions. That's a very sort of crude way of putting it. And obviously there are other things going on as well. But I do think it does come down a lot to deep pockets.
I think over a year ago, you were kind of warning about that the European Commission was going down this path. I don't know, maybe I just missed it. I didn't see the same concern or worry from others until those draft proposals were released. Is that kind of your read? Do you think people were asleep at the wheel?
For me, there's always been a tendency for the IP community, certainly on the originator side, on the sort of, the licensor side of the equation in deal making, to be reactive, that they kind of wait for stuff to happen and then say, oh, no, you can't do that. No, I think for whatever reason, they have never really got on the front foot and proactively made the case. I guess it's because the status quo suited them. And so they didn't want to change it. And so, you know, how do you're not going to spend a lot of money, I guess, going to protest and say, don't change the system. It's only when you feel there's a kind of a threat to the system that you get involved. But maybe over the years in the US as well as in Europe, the people on the other side have had much more motivation to go out and try and get things changed. They've been very, very good at creating narratives around small companies and mom and pop stores and all the rest of it. They know how to get the attention of legislators and policymakers. And, you know, by and large, they've been successful in getting what they wanted. I still have a feeling that we're a long way from the SEP regulation in Europe being implemented. I think that there seems to be enough holes in what's being produced by the Commission, enough flaws in it, that almost no one is happy with it. And there's quite a tight deadline to get it through its legislative path until before the next European elections and a new commission comes into place next year. So I wouldn't be surprised if in the end this didn't happen, at least for quite a while. But in the meantime, what we've got is uncertainty, and uncertainty is an absolute nightmare for everyone.
And you mentioned a bunch of these proposals. It seems like kind of a wish list for an implementer lobby, although they suggest otherwise. I mean, what do you think is going on? Are they just trying to see, well, which one of these proposals will survive scrutiny? Is it really a comprehensive set of proposals that the Commission thinks makes sense? What do you think, like, at the stage we are now, how should we view these proposals?
I think the implementers, it's a bad word, but the implementers, I don't think many of them are happy with what's turned up. There were quite a few last-minute changes to the so the regulation, which has, you know, upset the implementer side of the equation, but not enough changes to actually make the SEP holders feel very happy. And that's why I think there is, you know, serious potential for it not to happen. That if everyone is hacked off with it, it's going to be difficult to get momentum to get this through the process within the next sort of 12 to 18 months. And if it doesn't happen within the next 12 to 18 months, then, you know, it may not happen at all. I mean, for me, there's a really good opportunity to go back to the drawing board, start again, get everyone involved, get real evidence, identify what real problems might be and start to work together to solve them. But, you know, whether that happens or not, we'll see. Positions are so entrenched.
In the U.S., you know, sometimes lobbyists know they just have to hold out till the next administration comes in or a new Congress or so forth.
Yeah.
In Europe, for the European Commission, I guess as the director general, is that a term-limited position or how does that work?
My European law is not brilliant, but every 4 or 5 years there's a European Parliament election and at the same time the Commission changes. So the European Parliament will elect a new president of the European Commission and the president will then put together a new commission and it's, you know, there's a load of horse trading between member states and what have you. But yeah, there's no guarantee that the people that hold the positions now will hold those positions in 18 months' time. And if they go, the new people might well have new priorities and won't be interested in this. And, you know, the whole regulation will drop.
So at the same time you're hearing this follows short the unified patent court coming into existence. It's being heralded as supposedly it's going to be very patent friendly. Do you agree with that? How do you think the unified patent court the whole?
Well, I think the unified patent court potentially could be a de facto global patent court in many areas. I mean, I think one of the most extraordinary things that I've seen over the last few years is the US decide to give up injunctions in most cases. And as soon as you give up injunctions, you make your jurisdiction far less interesting to a lot of people that want to enforce their patents. And we've seen that over recent years with a shift to Germany and the UK to a lesser extent, and other European jurisdictions. And the Unified Patent Court would be Germany on steroids, potentially. So, you know, you go to Germany, get an injunction. It covers a very wealthy country of 80 million people. You go to the Unified Patent Court, you get an injunction. It covers, at the moment, I think, 17 countries, three G7 countries, population of around 400 million. Which is more than US. Yeah, I mean, it's a very, very powerful tool. So, you know, you go to the US, you might win after 5 years, $100 million, $200 million of damages. You go to the Unified Patent Court, and within a year, you might have an injunction that locks your locks the defendant out of a marketplace of 400 million people, which is potentially the more powerful, I would argue, the place that offers the injunction. But obviously, this is a new court. It's a court that's untested. So it's one that people are going to approach very warily, I think. We're not going to see a mountain of cases in the first year. We might see a few tentative cases. I think that the introduction of the regulation has made things even more uncertain because what the commission has basically done is said that they don't believe that judges at the Unified Patent Court or in national courts in the European Union are capable of solving FRAME-related patent disputes. Having said that, having given that very clear message, I think that's going to create even more uncertainty and unwillingness to use the UPC than would have been the case anyway. But, you know, in 2 or 3 years' time, if we don't have this regulation, if people have confidence in the UPC, you can see it being the place where people go to basically solve their disputes. And that would be a de facto global patent court.
Yeah, and I'm sure they do start leaning in a very pro-patent direction, then there'll be a new round of lobbying to kind of see what could be done about it.
Well, I mean, I think, it seems very difficult. I can't believe that you're going to set up a new court and sort of say it's created one patent jurisdiction in Europe and then have a load of judges that are going to be inclined to strike down every patent that comes in front of them. I think the chances are that if this court wants to be taken seriously, it's going to be seen as a court that will be friendly to patenting. I mean, that's obviously they're not going to be biased in favour of patent owners or anything like that, but they're going to be keen to ensure they get a good flow of cases. And you only get a good flow of cases if patent holders want to come and litigate in your court.
So we've been talking a lot about Europe, but you're based in London or the UK. Before we get to UK, you were not a fan of Brexit, but just seeing the European Commission at work and how much power it has, does that make you rethink, well, maybe Brexit is better than an alternative?
On a personal level, I wasn't a huge, well, I'm not a huge fan of Brexit. You know, I lived in Spain for 5 years and I had an incredible opportunity. And I'm very sad that my kids won't have that opportunity, but that's been taken away from them. And I think ultimately the UK is a European country and should be playing its part in Europe. From an IP perspective, if the Commission does go ahead with this regulation, if it passes, there's other moves that are kind of demonstrating the Commission is quite, you know, doesn't believe necessarily in strong patents. Strikes me there's a great opportunity for Brexit UK to set itself up in opposition to the Commission, to the EU in terms of IP as a very strong pro-IP, pro-patent jurisdiction. And the UK is big enough, I think, to actually pose some kind of opportunity for people. You know, we had Apple 2 years ago accept the fact that they would have to accept a FRAND injunction, sorry, a FRAND royalty rate set by a UK court on a global basis, that they couldn't pull out of the UK. They had to stay in the UK because the UK was such an important market for them. And if Apple's making that call, I imagine other people are as well. So, you know, if the EU doesn't want to be the place where patent disputes are decided, if the EU doesn't want to be pro-patent, then maybe the UK can. But, you know, overall, I wouldn't say that mitigates the downsides of Brexit. But, you know, I don't want to get too political about it. I wish it hadn't happened, but it has, and we've got to live with it.
I think in the recent past, and let me know if you think it's fair, UK has been known for having a weaker patent system than in the US and some of the major European countries. Give us some perspective about why you think that is. Is there a way that people in the UK thought about intellectual property rights as different? Or
I don't think the UK had a weaker IP system. I think it was more that in some situations, UK courts were less likely to uphold European patents or patents granted by the EPO than courts in other parts of Europe. So it wasn't the system per se. It was kind of the proclivity of judges to be less, you know, to be more sceptical, put it that way, of patents granted by the EPO than in other jurisdictions. If you talk to practitioners in the UK, they will say that that is much less the case these days, that the courts are more pro-patent. And we have seen decisions like Unwired Planet, which would indicate that as well. But I think there is a general perception internationally still that the UK maybe is less patent-friendly than other jurisdictions. And that's something that the UK has to work on. But in terms of an overall IP, system, I think the UK has one of the strongest in the world. Certainly, you know, in terms of attorneys, patent attorneys, trademark attorneys, patent private practice lawyers, people like that, then, you know, I think the UK is well up there in kind of the Premier League of the global table.
You mentioned that obviously IAM opened an office in Hong Kong, in China. For a while, it seemed there was a lot of hype about China has the strongest patent system.
Yeah.
It is the future model of the world. Everybody should go there. And I think you even wrote about it that, you know, in the recent past, people have been reminded, well, China is still controlled by the Chinese Communist Party. And really, that's at the heart of what China is. In reality, even if there are patent rights, those are at the whims of whoever controls the Communist China Party at the time. Do you think there was wishful thinking? Is it time for IAM to close down their Hong Kong office?
I think ultimately, in a country where there isn't an independent judiciary, you're always taking a chance. Clearly, China doesn't have an independent judiciary. But at the same time, I think a lot of the experiences of companies litigating in China is actually pleasant in terms of being a foreign patent owner trying to enforce your rights there. So I don't think it's as dark as all that, but clearly there are risks. What I would say about China is, yeah, there are a lot of downsides, but also I think I think about 10, 15 years ago to where China is now in terms of its sophistication around patents. You look at some of the companies, Xiaomi, Huawei, ZTE, Lenovo, people like that, they have incredibly sophisticated patent and IP operations run by incredibly knowledgeable people. And they're doing some of the most exciting things there are in IP. Look at the big decisions that are handed down, certainly in Europe, around SEPs. Unwired Planet involved Chinese companies. Huawei v. ZTE was two Chinese companies litigating against each other. So they're doing that great things. And the other thing that, they invest a hell of a lot of money in R&D, and that will pay dividends in the patents that they produce. So China is absolutely not a country that you can afford to ignore. It's absolutely central to the development of the global patent marketplace. It may not be the land of milk and honey that everyone thought it was, and obviously there are major sort of and wider geopolitical issues around China. But just in terms of patents and IP, I think China will continue to play a really important role for many years to come, probably forever.
The rest of Asia, Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, countries who are more aligned in terms of our Western values and so forth, their companies have some of the biggest patent portfolios in the world. But you don't hear much about those countries' internal approach to patents. Some of the stuff, this is just an example, I heard a Japanese attorney express surprise that a German court would rule against Daimler. Any thoughts about those collection of countries, about what's happening with their patent systems, about,
I think Japan is a country that's going through a very, very slow revolution when it comes to patents. I think companies in Japan are becoming a lot more aware of patents beyond being defensive assets. I think you're seeing more companies in Japan looking at the monetization opportunities around patents in a way that you didn't see a few years ago. That may not be playing through in the Japanese courts, but I think it certainly is in certain Japanese boardrooms. When we first went to Japan as IAM a decade ago, no one wanted to talk about monetization. Everyone was talking about patent trolls and things like that. If you go back to Japan now, I think there are many more sophisticated views of patents than there used to be. The country that's really interesting, obviously, is India in Asia. And, India is now emerging as a very important jurisdiction in terms of SEP FRAND. Indian courts at the moment are willing to give injunctions to SEP holders. And it's a huge market, and it's a market that's getting wealthier. So that is one to watch. And also, I remember having a conversation with someone from IV many years ago when they moved into Asia. And they said they went to various countries in Asia, and they were impressed with all of them. But what they saw in most countries was kind of a focus on incremental innovation. That, something would be invented elsewhere, and all these markets were really good at incrementally improving the basic product. And what they said was, in India, it's completely different. That they are all about looking at how you can disrupt. It's about disruptive invention and things like that. And I think if India can get its act together in terms of a strong patent system, a strong ecosystem around R&D and innovation, there's the potential for huge things in India. I mean, it doesn't seem to me to be a major coincidence that a lot of the really top quality engineers and CEOs that you see in places like Silicon Valley are from India. Now, if those people felt that they could stay in India and do stuff and they should start doing it, then, just think of the potential of that market.
Yeah, I agree about India. I think it's underhyped, if anything, about the potential that's there in the future. The last area, I guess, is South America. We see Brazil and Colombia are becoming strongholds for defending patent rights. particularly hear about in pharma and standard essential patent stuff. Did that development surprise you? Why do you think it came about, or is it?
Well, I think what's interesting about Latin America, and it, you know, we may see it in Africa in a few years' time, is in many ways technology is becoming commoditized. It's much easier to reproduce than it was in the past. It's much easier for people to buy because it's cheaper than it used to be. And so it's becoming more like trademarks, where the size of the population is actually a definitive aspect of the importance of the marketplace for a patent-owning company in a way that 10 or 15 years ago, it wasn't necessarily. So, you know, there are 400, I don't know what the population, you know, it's hundreds of millions of people live in Brazil. Most of those will have some kind of mobile telephone. You know, so they've got access to technology that wasn't there 10 years ago. That makes Brazil an incredibly important marketplace. And if you can go to Brazil and get an injunction, then why would you, why not? I mean, it's, you know, it's just as important as anywhere else. And, you know, Colombia, it's a smaller population, but, you know, it's a population that's getting wealthier. And if you can go to Colombia and get an injunction early, then it gives you some leverage in a global dispute. And I think the whole idea, you look at technology and how it's been commoditized, and you look at the size of the portfolios that people have and the number of countries in which they hold patents. Major SCP holders now will hold patents in dozens of countries. You know, if you look at a company like Philips or, Ericsson or Nokia or a company like that, they might have portfolios of families in 50 or even 60 jurisdictions. You know, that's what trademark owners typically do. It's not what patent owners used to do a few years ago. But that's all changing. You know, and the next frontier in a few years' time might be sub-Saharan Africa, because there's some big countries there that are growing quickly, that have big populations, that are getting wealthier. Once their IP systems are up and running and reliable, then why wouldn't you take cases to those countries too?
Now that we've covered the whole world, I guess, any other predictions about what might happen with regards to patent policies in the near future?
Oh, I couldn't make any predictions. I have a hope that people understand how important patents are, and that we don't make dramatic decisions around patents because they might help a few people over the shorter term. For me, it's always important to look at the long term and understand the long-term implications of the decisions that are being made. And it's only when you do that that I think you get effective policy making. And I worry too often with patents and other forms of IP that doesn't happen. So it's not a prediction, it's just a hope that maybe that will change. I wouldn't bet too much money on it though.
Appropriate for a journalist, right? not to be fully optimistic. I want to end, I guess, asking for two pieces of advice, kind of going back to your roots about trying to provide wisdom to chief IP officers. Any advice about succeeding on IP strategy business-wise when it comes to managing and intellectual property assets?
Yeah, I mean, I think, number one, you've got to make sure internally that everyone is on the same page, that the whole company understands your IP strategy, what it is and why it's important. And that's got to come from the board downwards. And as the chief IP officer, you are the ultimate advocate and the owner of that. And I think the other thing is to understand that there are always opportunities out there. You've just got to be creative about it. And if you work on that basis, then and you've got good patterns to play with, then you're likely to do well. So I suppose the best advice possible is make sure you've got good patterns.
That's a great advice. And helpful for my interest as well as a patent attorney. You know, to someone thinking of starting a media venture, what would your advice be to them in the IP media space or in media in general?
If you want to start a commercial operation, make sure you've got a buy-sell relationship. So make sure that you have a reader in the center of the circle and that you've got loads of spokes feeding into that circle. Just because something interests you doesn't mean it's going to interest everyone else. You've got to identify a marketplace, understand the relationships within that marketplace. And if you position yourself properly within that marketplace and then deliver a high quality product, the chances are the chances are not that you're going to be successful, but you're going to have a shot at doing something interesting.
Great advice. Thank you so much, Geoff, for doing this.
It's a pleasure. Great speaking to you.
Thank you for listening to Clause 8. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with others and leave a 5-star rating. I'd also like to thank my firm, Harity & Harity LLP, for their generous support. Clause 8 is produced by Great Feeling Studios and Brick Brewer. For more information, visit voiceofip.com. Thanks for listening.